Get started today. We have some initial business to take care of before we get to our first action item of the day. Begin with the safety briefing from Patricia.
Okay. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Natural Resources Building. In the event of a fire, alarms will sound and flash, and so please leave using the double doors in the front of the room. In the event of an earthquake, alarms may not sound and flash. So please drop to the floor and cover your head as best as you can or go under a table. After shaking has stopped, leave this room using, again, the double doors in the front of the room. In any evacuation of the building, staff will lead you out the building using the double doors in the front, then the first door on your left, leading you out towards Jefferson Street. There, DNR employees are trained and equipped to assist you in checking in and responding to emergencies. At this time, I ask that you silence your noise-making devices. Thank you.
Okay, we have a number of thank yous and introductions and personnel-related business to take care of before we get started today. And I'd like to start by asking David Whipple to join us up here at the table, if he's in the room. Hi, David. So, as board members know, David has served long as a representative to this board, as a member, as a staff person prior to that, and I share all of your appreciation for David's hard work and dedication to protecting public resources and faithfully implementing the Port Praxis Act. We have a plaque of appreciation for David for service to the people of Washington as a member of the Port Praxis Board from December 2011 to July 2013. David, we congratulate you on your new opportunities and thank you very much for your service.
Thanks, sir.
I'm knocking on the new door of the new office.
Awesome.
So there you can get your name flat.
I was hoping.
Yeah, I'm sure you were.
Thanks very much.
Is there anything you'd like to share with the board?
There is, without taking up too much time, but I guess I would just like to thank everybody. I've been in Forest Praxis since, for the most part, since 93 when I came here. And I was kind of reflecting back a little bit, and one thing that John Mankowski told me when I first started back then was that the work that everybody does, it's hard work, it takes a long time, it's frustrating at times, but at the same time, when the change does come, it's a long-lasting, really significant change. And I think that still holds true today. And so keep your heads up and your noses down and keep working, because what you guys do is super, super important. And I just appreciate having the opportunity to be on the board and interacting with both the current board members and the past board members, and also all the staff and all the stakeholders that we work with every day. And just appreciate all the relationships that I've been able to build over the years and the friendships. And keep up the great work, and we'll see you around. Thanks very much.
So with that, we have two new board member or two board member introductions to do. First is a familiar face. The director of Department of Fish and Wildlife sent a message to the board informing us that Joe Storer had been appointed as WDFW's representative to the board. I'm very happy to have Joe with us. I know you're going to make great contributions to the work here, and if you have anything you'd like to share with us, please.
No, I'm happy to be here, and looks like we've got a lot of work to do, so
let's do it.
And Kirk Cook, who's our Department of Ag representative, is not able to make the meeting today. And so Julie Morgan is joining us as Kirk's stand-in. Julie, thanks for making yourself available, and we appreciate your help. Anything you'd like to share before? All right, we'll get cracking on the rest of our introductions then. So as the board knows, we've had a search ongoing for a Forest Praxis Division Manager for some period of time now. We have, for the last month or so, enjoyed the help and service and leadership of Donnell Mahan as Acting Division Manager for Forest Praxis. Donnell normally serves as our Assistant Division Manager for Operations. I've been impressed with Donnell's work. I think she is an excellent resource for the department and for stepping into the breach when we need someone to fill in. I'd like to thank her in my way of introduction, introduce you all to Donnell.
Thank you.
Sitting behind Donnell and observing for today, but reporting for official duty as permanent Fort Knox's division manager is Chris Hanlonmeyer, the guy in the blue shirt back there. So Chris comes to us from the department's aquatics program and has done, as I think I sent in a message to the board, has done a lot of great work for the department in aquatics, and we look forward to his contributions to the board's practices. I'm really excited to have Chris, and I know you all get to know him real well. So that, I think, covers our introductions. There is, you'll note in the agenda, a bit of a qualification on the public comment period, since that's coming up later in the day, and I want to just note, as we're proceeding into the first action item, that we have two permanent rulemakings, two final actions on rulemakings, for which the board has solicited comments through the normal procedures, had hearings, and so today we are not accepting comments on the two final rulemaking items. And want to remind everyone of that. It's in the meeting, or in the meeting agenda, so please keep that in mind. With that, first action item we have on the agenda is the approval of the minutes. And Patricia, do you have changes that have been requested from board members?
Yeah.
Joe, you have one?
Yeah, I'd like to offer, if I could, two clarifications. I think Patricia has them available on the screen. So the first is to page 3, lines 17 through 19. I'd like to insert the words site-specific prescriptive and strike instructive. And then moving on in that sentence, add the words more minimum standard, paren one size fits all, close paren nature, and strike the word certainties. Again, these are clarifications that Dave Whipple asked to make in terms of his presentation.
Let's take them together.
And then the second is page 7, lines 19 through 25. To add the words after forest practices rule, add the words for nest trees, and strike, following on in that sentence, strike the word recommended and add the word committed, WDFW2. I think you can see that there.
Okay, any questions from board members about that addition to the minutes? Any further additions or clarifications to the minutes that we need to suggest, Paul?
I'd like to make a request for minor clarification for the discussion in that same section on Western gray squirrels. So it's towards the bottom of page 7, where it says Paulus Woodin requested WDFW be considered where the rulemaking is necessary. I'd like to amend that to say requested the board consider whether rulemaking is necessary after the results of the November meeting. That was the intent of my statement there. So not to reconsider rulemaking at the time that the petition was presented.
Help Patricia make the
suggestion. Replace WDFW with the board, and then remove reconsider and just have it be considered. Mm-hmm. And then whether rulemaking is necessary, so after necessary, say after the results of the November meeting. That's great. Thank you.
Questions or clarifications from board members on that proposed change? Any further adjustments to the minutes we need to consider? Seeing none at this time, I'd like to have a motion to approve the minutes as amended.
So moved.
Phil's moved. We have a second?
Second.
Second for Bob. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say no. Any abstentions? Motion's approved. Thank you. We sort of already covered the report from the chair. I don't have a great deal to add. We've got a busy agenda today, and if I can save ourselves a few minutes moving ahead with public comments, I think we should do so. That's what we'll do. Patricia, who are our sign-ups for the general comment period. Okay, we have three folks and 10 minutes, so let's say 3 minutes apiece. First is Mary Spurlock from Conservation Caucus. Please join us.
Morning. My name is Mary Spurlock. I'm the Conservation Caucus representative to the Policy Committee. I apologize for the computer in front of me, but I didn't have a printer available. I just wanted to briefly do a little bit of sharing from my perspective in the Policy Committee about some things. The first would be, and I don't think this violates the rule against talking about things that have been through public comment because I'm going to talk about it at a higher level. Just wanted to mark that today's adoption, which I expect to occur, of the adaptive management rule pursuant to the settlement agreement is an important milestone. And that key improvements are being made to the adaptive management program through that rule, and that significant changes were made to the settlement agreement to accommodate non-parties to that, but we still have, I think, a really excellent result. Just to summarize really quickly, we have one vote for nine caucuses, we have a prioritized work plan, we have dispute resolution timelines that are significantly shortened, we have CMER having access to dispute resolution, we have agreement to use a master schedule that will be adopted at the end of 2013, and have periodic review of that, and we have the board making regular determinations about compliance with that master schedule. And so, in sum, we're basically on course to meet the settlement agreement commitments, which I think is a real accomplishment. And just to acknowledge real quickly, there's other work that's still to be done outside of the rules, but every indication is that we will be continuing to work together on the funding issues. Just wanted to quickly touch base on the Type F dispute resolution from a perspective a little bit different than the co-chairs. As you may know, policy is facing an extreme challenge to agree even on the parameters for a process to evaluate the extent to which current stream typing methods are adequate to meet the goals of the HCP and forest and fish. It does seem possible at this juncture that key aspects of this discussion could be elevated to the board for resolution in the near future. Because of the delicate phase of the negotiations, it's been much appreciated that members of the board have taken an interest in that resolution. To remind you, we are following up on guidance to implement a hybrid approach since 2005, which has not been fulfilled. We are again hard at work on that issue. Although we have not reached agreement on some key fundamentals, on the positive side, we have reached agreement on the broad strokes of key issues that we hope to deal with. So more to come on that. Similarly, we are still in discussion, although not in dispute resolution per se. We are in fairly time-consuming discussions over implementation of the Type N strategy, which was approved several months ago. But we are still working on coming to agreement over submission of board manual guidance describing methods to identify the uppermost points of perennial flow. And the focus of the debate is around the sufficiency of the existing CMER-derived data supporting proposed default values for identifying these points in the wet season. That's the focus of our discussion. And our working goal is still to submit board manual language to the board by February if agreement can be reached on the path forward. So again, a lot of work happening there, no resolution, but some indication that board involvement could be called for. So thanks.
Thanks, Mary. Doug Hooks, please join us.
Hi there, board.
Thank you.
Doug Hooks with Washington Forest Protection Association. I wanted to just got a couple comments on compliance monitoring for you today. Going to be having the first annual report, whereas normally you have a biannual report. And I was at the request of the commissioner. I just wanted to appreciate the level of detail and effort that went into that report. It was extremely well written, and hopefully it will serve as a template that will make things more efficient for report writing in the future. As noted throughout this report, though, it's just 1 year of 2 years' worth of samples. So it's very difficult to take much information from that. The sample size was selected to meet a confidence interval for a biennial sample. So there's not enough samples to make a statistical precision from 1 year's worth. I can appreciate there's a big change this year. It was changed from formally stratifying things by regions and looking at the sample sizes by regions to looking at them by prescription types for the state. And that provided some more flexibility for the compliance monitoring program to be able to provide, for sampling types, providing more sampling prescription types, adding to that report in the future. However, I want the DNR to hopefully be able to continue to look at the data post hoc so that we can still check for consistencies or issues that may occur within regions so that, you know, this is a report not just of the landowner compliance, but also of DNR's approval in each region. Sorry, I'm just all over myself. I'm just going completely blank. I apologize. I also appreciate the change in reporting from the compliance and non-compliant reporting format to the compliant and the deviation format. That's a slightly change. It's a change from the reporting in the past where things can be reported from a major and a moderate and an intermediate non-compliance. So it gives you some more qualitative description of the resource protection. That also kind of gets at the difficulty that there is in providing a complete picture of compliance. There are many different forest practice rules that direct a prescription type, and DNR has not found a way to quantitatively estimate a compliance percentage for individual prescriptions. Compliance rates are provided are only an estimate of the percentage of the prescription type samples that are in compliance. Thus, noting the compliance interval for the rates is very informative. So it's very, very important that you look at the confidence intervals around the compliance rates in order to be able to understand what it's actually reporting. Okay.
Thanks, Doug. Chris Mendoza.
Yes, if the board would request that my time be yielded to Peter Goldman.
I didn't sign up, so. Good morning, board. Peter Goldman, director of the Washington Forest Law Center, representing the Conservation Caucus. We'd just like to talk a little bit about what's coming up to the board on the type F issue, which is the fish habitat issue. Page 2 of the memo from Steve Bernath and Adrian Miller touches upon it, but I just thought I wanted to provide a little bit more detail because I think it's important and it's coming, it appears to be coming to the board. Right now, as most of you know, we are in an interim water typing rule. We have not adopted a permanent water typing rule. And the interim rule provides that any strain that exceeds 2 feet in width or 20% gradient, or less than 20% gradient, is presumed fish. But landowners are able to go out with electric backpacks and actually eliminate habitat by testing for fish through quarter mile lengths all the way up the stream. At the time that the Forest and Fish HCP was signed, the idea was going to be that there was going to be an electronic model that predicted where the break was between the fish habitat and the non-fish habitat. But in 2005, this board decided, after CMER reviewed the model, that it did not meet the requisite level, confidence level of accuracy. So we're in the hybrid rule right now, the interim rule, where we have this presumption of fish, but that can be eliminated. So for the past year and a half, in at least 6 or 7 all-day meetings, policy committee and subgroups of it have been grappling with the question of how are we going to identify fish habitat without depending so heavily on the electric shocking of streams. And what appears to be the conflict is that there's a reluctance on behalf of some to actually describe fish habitat. It's that simple. We don't have a model to tell us where it's going to be that maybe overpredicts in some and underpredicts in some areas. But at one point, we need to get down to a basic cookbook kind of rule, like we do with board manuals generally, to describe what habitat is and what the limits of it are in the vertical reaches and even more importantly, in the off-channel areas. It's our caucus's position, and I think most of the caucus's positions, that we can and need to do a better job describing what this habitat is because we are not protecting the fish habitat that is out there that needs to be protected. I mean, as you know, it's huge, the difference between type F and type N. Type F gets the standard buffer. Type F gets a 50-foot buffer for half the stream length. So we're out there clear-cutting a lot of potential type F streams and off-channel areas that should be buffered. So what's coming, I believe, what's coming your way soon will be the question of whether or not we should proceed to start writing a regulation that actually describes what fish habitat is, so we can try to phase out the electronic elimination of habitat through that method. So that's what's coming your way. We're trying to grapple with it at policy. It's not easy developing the description of fish habitat, but in good faith, we're all working together to see if we can get there. But I'm not sure we're going to be able to get there. We might be coming to this board with a split recommendation on how to do this. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. So we now proceed into the staff report portion of the agenda. I have one item I'd like a little more discussion on, and it's the Small Forest Landowner Office and Advisory Committee report. So Tammy, would you come up and join us, please? Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the board. My name is Tammy Makita, and I am the Small Forest Landowner Office Manager for the Forest Practices Division.
Thanks, hey, Tammy. This past year, I want the board members to be aware, was a sort of flurry of activity around conservation programs in Small Forest Landowner Office, specifically with respect to the Fish Passage Barrier projects through the Family Forest Fish Passage Program, as well as the Forestry Riparian Easement Program. And Tammy, your report notes some of those accomplishments. I also wanted board members to be sort of up to date on the planned work for 2013, calendar 2013, and I guess fiscal 14. We received an appropriation, a capital appropriation for the Forestry Riparian Easement Program for this fiscal biennium, 13-15 biennium, and that was
$2 million.
$2 million.
That's correct.
And then an additional amount for Family Forest Fish Passage Program, which of course comes through the Office of the Governor's Office of Recreation and Conservation. And that was a $3 million appropriation.
That was $2
million. Another $2 million.
Correct.
So we've got approximately how much of the jobs bill funding left to obligate?
We have about $6 million left to obligate for this coming.
So $8 million total for Family Forest Fish Passage in,
that's correct.
In this biennium.
That's correct.
And do you have an updated number on the up-to-date, the most recently updated, I guess, number of remaining barriers? Do you have that right off the top of your head?
Well, we have 47 barriers that we're going to be removing for this construction season. It's going to be opening up about 161 stream miles, and for the 2014 construction season, we plan on removing another 50 barriers. So these are nearly double the number of barriers that we removed in a biennium. So we've been really, really busy, very active.
I appreciate the work of the office and its staff on putting those projects on the ground and with our partners in a way that's efficient and responsible. And I think these programs are a conservation success.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I think, though, the board, we probably want to review the roster of REP projects, forestry riparian easement projects that were approved last year. There, as you recall, was an update to the legislation in 2009. I think that was 2009 legislative session, the eligibility of REP. And I think it's worth the board checking in on the roster of projects that was completed in the last fiscal cycle and perhaps those that are in the queue for upcoming. I think the backlog of FREP or the applications in queue for FREP totals about $13 million or so.
That's correct. We have 107 applications right on the list still. So but about a five-year backlog.
I think it's worth a
board. $2 million.
Right. Right. And so I think it's worth a board check-in on the implementation of the FREP statute updates and the types of projects that we've got in the queue. So we'll look to do that perhaps at the November meeting.
Absolutely.
We also have questions for Tammy.
The 107, if I could. The 107, was it?
That you said? That's correct.
Are they approved for action if we receive the money?
Yeah. Yes, they are. They're all eligible to be compensated.
Anything else for Tammy? Thanks.
Great, thank
Other
you.
Other questions from board members on the staff reports that we received? Hearing none. That brings us to the compliance monitoring annual report, and we're over 15 minutes ahead of schedule, so we can get out here at a reasonable hour this afternoon.
Just banking time for later.
Morning, Mr. Chair and Board. My name is Seth Barnes. I'm the interim assistant force practices division assistant manager for operations. Just wanted to real quick before I turn it over to Walt for a brief report, let you know or remind you that you received a copy of the full report in your board mailing, and so we'd appreciate it if we'd be welcome to answer any detailed questions you might have offline, but for interest of time, we'd like to keep things a little bit more general and moving along, if possible, for interest of your other topics. But we'd be more than happy to answer your questions offline or get into to discussions there if you have them. So without further ado, I'll turn the time over to Walt.
Okay. Good morning, Chair and Board members. Our purpose here is to provide a summary of the 2012 results, and at the end, maybe answer any questions you might have about the report. Please remember the results are for the standard sample are for 1 year of a two-year biennium. And it does not have the design reliability that we're expecting in the two-year report. But it has been a useful exercise to essentially prepare for this second year report and provide the results for the emphasis sample. Additionally, 2012 looks at somewhat less than half the biennium sample due to some changes in the time period of the population selection. Looking at the standard sample summary right here, this table kind of describes the scope of what we looked at in 2012, and it's working the same things in 2013. So it shows the geographic region, the prescriptions, each prescription type, the sample size, and the estimated population size. Kind of at first look, these population estimates seem a bit low, but it is not the case. Other 2797 FPAs in the population for 2012, we don't assess those which have no type water on the application. So this pretty much excludes all the notifications and all those which have no harvest and those which have herbicide spray only. We also don't observe those for which the operations are not complete. And they expected to be complete and they didn't turn out that way. That is about 14% of FPAs, of all submitted FPAs eventually get resubmitted for renewal. So the focus of what we observe here is directed at the prescriptions of the forest and fish report that affect water. So the scope's limited and does not really encompass the entire universe of forest practice rules. Some have expressed, well, aren't you just biasing the sample that way? Well, not really. It's the way the framers of the program said this is the scope of what we want to look at. This is also a first year of a design change that was instituted to provide better confidence intervals. You look at the sample counts there, and some of those sample counts are more than the entire biennium of the previous biennium. We designed this to even out the sample size so that we can tell more what's going on in each prescription type. So when we get the combined sample of 2013, we're expecting to report averages which have a compliance or a confidence interval of 12%, plus or minus, which is much better than the previous biennium. So looking at the riparian results from 2012, looking at a 20-acre exempt emphasis sample. We originally designed it as a sample, but there were 70 in the time period we were looking at, and only 28 had completed operations. So we looked at all 28. So it was essentially a census of what we were looking at, of the entire available population to look at. There was no statistical difference between 2008 and the 2012 samples. Of the 12 particular of RMZs with deviation from compliance, three had major severity, four had moderate severity, and four had minor severity. And one, the severity was indeterminate. The standard sample, we looked at 14 Western Washington no outer zone harvests and four east side harvests. Let's see, one of the west sides had a minor deviation, and the one on the east side actually did have a major non-compliance deviation. The seven minor deviations for the no inner zone harvest, four of these were insufficient solely for outer zone leaf trees. The other three had trees removed from the inner zone. Of the 11 east side, two had a minor deviation. DSC2s, there were three with minor deviation. DSC1s, there was one major deviation, had trees cut from the core and was missing trees from the inner zone. Type NP, RMZs, and LNZs. The west side sample, 14, had one was minor, and the east side sample, all four were compliant. Of type NS, ELZs, the west side sample had nine, one deviation of minors of indeterminate severity, and east side had four, they were all fully compliant. WMZs are statewide prescription. It's the same across the both sides of the mountains. Of the two, there was deviation occurred only in type A. Of these, two occurred because there were the type A's actually had type F physicals associated with them to the wetland edge, and they needed a type F RMZ. The other two had too many trees harvested, and one was moderate because the trees had harvested in all size classes. On the road sample, of those FPAs that had road construction abandonment, we sampled 17, and all of these were compliant. We looked at the rules under 222.24 and just essentially examine those and go down and see that those BMPs were in place and that it did not have the potential to deliver. The haul route survey, a little slightly different design. We had 87% compliance. It's, you know, that average is lower than 2011, but it is not statistically different at this point in the game. Sample size of that was 32. So in the discussion, the standard sample of 2012 is too small to reliably detect any trends. This means those values that we've presented today can change drastically with the inclusion of the 2013 sample. So don't be either too dismayed or too optimistic by these results. Of the exempt 20-acre RMC FPAs, the program will be looking at some operational changes that were made in 2011 and designed to improve the compliance of the exempt 20s, and they weren't realized. So we're going to be looking at that, the program will be looking at that. In general, compliance monitoring has been a real useful detection program about where to focus compliance efforts. So far, compliance monitoring identified water typing as a major compliance issue. Since then, some operational changes have been made. The watertight modification form and the classification worksheet have been changed. That's used in the approval process. The issues have been explained at all TFW meetings and DNR district worst practice meetings. We also implemented and completed an agency-wide water typing and bank pool width training, so to provide that to so that the forest practice foresters are seeing this in a consistent with a consistent eye and consistently making those assessments. Going forward, we already have 75% of the 2013 sample and had a schedule on that. We got an early start on the forest practice FPA screening and field work. We resolved some protocol interpretation issues over the year and introduced some new field scheduling techniques that brought that automatic notification of participants. So this has allowed the program some time in the next couple months to prepare for the 2014 sample. We want to design tests and methods to deal with some of the sampling challenges with measurement error and highly variable conditions. And look at alternative designs to better represent what the nature of compliance is. So that's where we are. Any questions?
I've got a couple on, can you talk a little bit about the measurement error and precision of the measurements and what's tied up in that issue? Because it does underlie a lot of the compliance results.
It does. Issues resolve around or rotate around the type of measurements we take from the streams and looking at the different RMZ widths. What we find is that we go through and we measure and we may place the ribbon, we measure pretty precisely, say the 50 foot core, the 70 foot inner zone, and then an outer zone. Where those flags get placed depends on where those trees get counted. So what we will find is that there's variability, particularly between the inner zone trees and the outer zone trees. And sometimes we're pretty sure that the applicant thought, this is an inner zone tree, I'm going to leave it. But we measured, it falls on the outer zone side of the line, so we count it as an outer zone tree. And if they're doing a DSC-1, that will cause the applicant to be a short on the DSC-1 trees. The tree is still there, it's just in the wrong load. So it's an accounting issue. And I think we have to deal with that to treat the program the applicants fairly.
And right now there's sort of a 5%.
There's a 5% measurement error. But that's only in the core. We don't have a measurement error associated between Arizona and outer zone. And that's a protocol change we need to make. How wide that's going to be is going to require some analysis.
A clarification on that. On the inner zone and the outer zone, it's within a foot?
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's
and how are you measuring them? Is it tape?
We measure with a laser with a filter, with a reflector. The stream edge and we measure that. So the measurements are within it. So we have pretty high confidence in our measurements, but it depends upon where, at what point along the stream you measure it, because with the sinuosity of the stream, it will put it in different places than what the landowner is. So.
Okay. Just curious, the moderate and major problem areas, are those more of a landowner forester problem or a logger problem that's not up to speed on what he should be doing?
Can I answer this one?
Yes, you can.
I would say that compliance monitoring doesn't really look into who made the error. That gets passed off to the operations side of the department, which we have a very close tie-in with compliance monitoring, of course. In passing that on to the regions to do the assessments. And I think it varies depending on the situation. Our field staff is used to making those assessments as far as you know, what is, are things marked in the wrong place, or is this just operator error? And then how gross, you know, in terms of the actual error, or how far out of compliant are they, and what's the real issue here? What's the pattern going on?
So, if you take the minor and the ones that are okay, I mean, because minor can be one tree, what's your goal to get everybody compliant? Are we looking for a 90% compliance rate, a 95% compliance rate? And how do we educate and check on the people that are making the moderate and the major problems to make sure that they don't continue to do them again?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Like,
being the ops ADM, I'm fairly comfortable and certain about these guys doing their job, but I do want to jump in and explain. There are a few things that we're looking at as far as minors, majors, moderate. It's about the pattern that's being completed on the landscape that we're very interested in identifying. That's where we look and convey that information to our regions. The compliance monitoring program does not engage in enforcement. It's really about identifying what's on the land base and reporting that back. On the operations side of the house and the regions, that's where they will engage further with the landowners. We're doing education through multiple ways. Walt alluded to the Bankville Lift water typing training. Not only are our staff getting that training, but we're going to turn around and give that training at all TFW meetings. So that will include WDFW's habitat biologists, landowners, anybody and everybody can come, and we're setting up modules to explain how to do water typing. A component of that will be done in the field. That's the expectation. So the other ways that we're trying to educate is through the Washington Contract Lawyers Association training, and the other way is through enforcement. And lowest level possible, but informal conference notes let landowners know that they have them in, they have deviated, and it's letting them know to the extremity up to violations that do take place. But that is done in the regions. Does that answer your question?
Yep. Paul?
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the issues you've been encountering with non-compliance with the 20-acre exempt parcels. Talk about the nature of the non-compliance and why it seems to be kind of a stubborn issue that's been hard to get at.
Okay. The nature of it is that it's a small... It's a small portion of total applications, so we're going out and we're looking at all of them. The assessment that we're looking at typically small landowners that don't have a lot of experience with it, typically one or two times that it may be that small landowner's only time they're going to harvest, so they usually get a contractor in to do that. The thing that we really wanted to focus on is that is what's missing from the RMZ. So a number of times they measured the streams too small, so they needed a larger RMZ, or they've entered the RMZ as it was and have taken out some larger trees. Whether whose fault that was, we don't know. I know in one instance there was a consultant foresters that came in with us to review the site and said, no, I'd mark those trees to stay, and the operator let them take them. So, yeah. So does that get at what you're...
The reason I was asking is I seem to remember at the last meeting there was some public testimony from the small landowner community wanting to, you know, look at ways to expand the use of the 20-acre exemption. And it just raises some concerns for me if there's lots of compliance issues with the way that exemption is being implemented now. I'd want to make sure that we were really on top of that prior to any consideration of expansion of that sort of, or expansion of the application of that exemption.
I think it's fair to say, as far as the report's conclusions go, that there was an initial compliance strategy that the department implemented based on prior results for 20-acre exempt, and that involved notification within a couple of days of commencement of harvest activities so that you get a compliance staff person on site to make sure that things were happening as were approved in the application. And it just was a non-successful strategy. And so I think it's incumbent on the department to look at the pattern of compliance and devise a different strategy to try and bump the numbers up. You know, for the part of the board, part of myself, I don't think a 50-some-odd percent or 60-some-odd percent compliance rate on a particular prescription like that one, even recognizing that the population of the applications is relatively low, is something that, you know, is good enough. And it does need improvement. I'm confident that the department is working on it. But it's a hard one. Mm-hmm. So it's a complicated prescription to implement sometimes. Tom?
Thank you. I had similar concerns. In terms of the size of the problem, I just wanted to confirm what I think I'm reading here. Only 2.2% of the applications are 20-acre exempt.
That's from taken from a previous report.
So in terms of landscape, do you have a sense of what percentage of the harvested landscape, the 20 acres?
My sense would be that it would be smaller than 2% because they're by definition limited to 20 acres.
Yeah, but it is a very important section, particularly when we think about expanding that or how we implement it. And I was, and maybe this isn't, the report isn't really the place for this, but looking at the recommendations section, it basically says we're going to need to work on this. And it doesn't suggest, you know, kind of this discussion we're having here is where does the problem lie? Is it education with the landowner? Is it education with the contract logger? Is it maybe an enforcement issue? When will we have that conversation, or is that done? Yeah. Done? She's going to fix it.
It's okay. That'll hit you. So we didn't want to supply recommendations with an interim report with only 1 year. We'll give our recommendations.
Except for this was the emphasis area, right?
It is, but what we plan on doing is those 20-acre exempts will be drawn in population sample-wise through the standard sample. So we'll continue to bring those in. And its answer to your question is yes, all three. Education, working with Washington Contract Loggers Association, also probably trying to monopolize on the forestry days, educational opportunities, getting some hands-on discussion with folks, and then lowest level enforcement possible, but it's really, a lot of these are one-hit wonders. They're coming in once, they sell the property or someone inherits it after they pass away. That's where we're at. So it's looking at the other side of the business, and that's the operators. And again, including into patterns and moving forward in that venue. We're also discussing with other stakeholders how we can try to be more successful in this and drawing them into some educational components.
Can I follow that up by just saying that this is one of this area that we've just delved into for a couple minutes is one of the areas that points out the value of the compliance monitoring program to our department in helping us understand overall trends and larger statewide trends that helps us focus our operations and education and just everything. So just know that we are definitely following through on a lot of this information, and it's been a great help for us.
Other questions on compliance monitoring interim report? Thank you very much, gentlemen. Jeffrey and Karen, I saw Jeffrey come in. Are you ready to come up just a bit early?
Good morning. It's great to have you invite us in today for the annual report. And so my name is Jeffrey Thomas. I'm the co-chair of the Timber, Fish, and Wildlife Cultural Resources Roundtable. And I have with me my fellow co-chair, Karen Turwell, is our And so I'll go ahead and just start with the annual report and more or less mention our roundtable members. And so we have active members that we really rely upon, and that's Sherry Felix with the DNR, Lee Stilson with the DNR, Gretchen Kaler with Department of Archaeology and Historic Preservation, David Powell of the Yakima Nation, Dave Burlingame of the Cowlitz Tribe, Robert Bass and Jesse Narab of Hancock Forest Management. So we really appreciate their contributions and the dedication that they have. But as for FY 2013 work activities, we'll just give you an overview of what they are. Karen's going to go ahead and describe some things about our Cultural Resources Protection Management Plan Use and Effectiveness Survey Project. And then I'll go ahead and mention a couple of other items that are in last year's calendar, and then we'll talk about some upcoming activities. So you'll see that in the annual report, we do provide a summary of the work activities and just overall the key topics that were worked upon by the TFW Cultural Resources Roundtable. They did involve upgrades to the Forest Practices Application Question 7 instructions, historic maps and information user's guidance, a use and effectiveness survey of both WAT 222-2120, as well as the Cultural Resources Protection Management Plan document itself. We also worked on completing some Cultural Resource Protection Management Plan guidance documents, and we undertook roundtable outreach and education, which is just a regular feature of our work. That I'd say that the upgrades to the Forest Practices Application Question Number 7, those instructions are important to ensure that applicants are fully aware of the procedural expectations, as well as on-site features that are critical for them to consider when evaluating their units for cultural concerns. The historic maps and information guidance, it fosters greater detection of significant sites, and the use and effectiveness surveys, they're important for evaluating the efficiency, the sufficiency of the WAC requirements, and as well as assessing how well the rules and voluntary processes and or fulfilling the purposes of the Cultural Resource Protection Management Plan are progressing. The CREP guidance documents, they recommend approaches to use when detecting or protecting cultural resources, and the roundtable outreach and education provides a framework through which multi-stakeholder cultural resources information can be coordinated. And so we undertook those particular activities last year because of those specific values. As far as the Forest Practices Application Question 7 instructions, of course, the Forest Practices Application does have a cultural resources question. It's number 7, and there's instructions that accompany answering that question. So we focused upon those and the possibility of upgrading some of the language. And so the present version of the instructions, it doesn't offer any information regarding historic sites and doesn't refer to any of the pertinent RCWs, WACs, or other documents that may be important, or it doesn't really indicate whether high probability geographic features should be noted upon FPA maps. And so various upgrades to the instructions have been considered by the roundtable during this last year, and next week they'll actually be holding a meeting to try to finalize their recommendations, and so those should be coming forward to the DNR very soon. As far as historic maps and information's guidance go, it would be the work that was undertaken by Lee Stilson in most part, and he prepared a document titled Working with Historic Maps to Identify Cultural Resources in Washington State, and he discusses the use of these sources and provides links to web pages that contain historic maps and other sources. We're sure that that will help improve knowledge and understanding and use of the GLO, the historic and current USGS quad maps, or other public information as tools that will help identify cultural resources. So we do consider that very important. And now I'll hand it over to Karen so she can talk about the use and effectiveness survey project.
Good morning, Chair Everett and members of the board. Thank you again for having us here. I'm Karen Terwilliger with the Washington Forest Protection Association, and I'm the co-chair of the TFW Cultural Resources Roundtable. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the survey that we undertook. Now, this survey we did in response to board direction to look at how well the CRMP, our Cultural Resources Management Plan, and WAC 222-20120 work in the field. And so this is the second year of this survey. Last year we had our initial stab at it, and there were probably too many questions, too long of questions, too confusing of questions. And so what we did this year is revamp the survey. so that we reduce the length of the survey. We focus the questions very carefully. And for those of you who ever worked on a survey instrument, it takes a lot of time just to get those questions right so that people that aren't necessarily as familiar as you are with the issues can actually answer them in an appropriate way. The third thing that we did was we changed the distribution system. Instead of relying on some of the lists that were here at the Department of Natural Resources, we expanded that and looked at putting the information through the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission. We talked to the Washington Forest Farm Association, we talked to WFPA lists, and so we sent the information out pretty broadly. Even with that broad distribution, we only got about 134 respondents, but the good news about that is that that was almost double from last year in terms of the folks that actually completed the instrument. And so it was a very effective way to get more information out. And next year, we plan to enhance that distribution system even more. What I noticed with some of the distribution lists is I'm on a lot of them, and so I got the survey several times. We need to do a better job in just getting that out. So, with no further ado, just to the results, if you look on page 2 and 3 of your handout, you'll see that we have about a 69% increase in total response. Approximately 50% of the folks that responded were forest landowners. About 33%, about a third of the overall survey was industrial forest landowners, and then approximately 16% was small forest landowners. Now that's a change from last year in which we didn't have very good response at all from the small forest landowners. About 11% were tribal representatives, and about 28% were state agency folks. Those are folks that deal with forest practices either at Department of Natural Resources or potentially some other state agencies or local agencies as well. 12% identified themselves as other, and you never really know who those people are. But they're interested in forest practices and cultural resources, and that's a great thing. In terms of the information that we got back from these folks, about 80% noted that they occasionally or often encounter cultural resources in their jobs. And what was really a surprising number to me was about 63% of those people that did encounter this had a contract with a professional archaeologist or employed an archaeologist on their staff, which means that folks are taking this requirement pretty seriously in terms of providing a level of professionalism in the staff that is really excellent and surprising. The next element of the survey is to look at how well WAP 2220120 is working. And there are 5 different options that we had out there in terms of how forest landowners interact with tribes on a site-by-site basis. And in order of most to least utilized, first the most people were looking at a meeting taking place between the tribe and the landowner, and a plan was agreed to. This is really good news in terms of the way that the outreach is working with forest landowners and how they're cooperating with the tribes. Second, the second option was that the tribe confirmed that there were no cultural resources concerned with the application, which I think indicates a couple of things. One is that the tribes are taking those forest practices applications and looking at them very carefully, but making sure that they utilize their time and the landowner's time very professionally. And if there are no cultural resources issues at that point, making sure that DNR knows that. The third most frequent was that a meeting did not take place, but under the WAC, there's an ability for a landowner, after repeated tries and attempts to talk to the tribes, to be able to document that information to Department of Natural Resources, and that was next in line. Number 4 bullet was meeting took place, but no plan was agreed to. Again, what's really important there is that meetings are actually taking place. And then finally, other documentation was accepted by DNR. So it looks like the program is actually working pretty well. In terms of specific numbers, about 44% of all respondents actually had participated in a meeting between tribes and landowners and managers. About 70% of the time, which is a pretty high percentage, plans were agreed to for the protection of cultural resources. This next statistic is a little bit surprising, but about 60% of the respondents felt that when plans were agreed to, cultural resources were well protected, and landowner and manager objectives were met. That's a pretty high number. Or looking at the collaboration between the tribes and the landowners in terms of protecting cultural resources. The next number was a little surprising too. About 40% felt that cultural resources were well protected, but in some way landowner objectives were compromised. And I think this is one area where we need to look at more information in the next survey to explain exactly what is meant by that. But that was an interesting finding. As you look down the list of additional statistics, about 67% feel that there was always or usually a very respectful discussion between the tribe and the landowner, which is very important. And then in terms of confidentiality, which is a critically important element, I think, both to the tribes and to the landowners, about 41% felt that the information was always kept confidential, and 18% felt that it was usually kept confidential. So, again, I think that the survey indicates that the information that we have out there about the plan as well as the WAC is working in the process. We are looking to find ways to increase the information coming back to us through the survey, particularly from small forest landowners. I found an interesting statistic on yet another study that was done by the U.S. Forest Service. It was a study or a survey of landowners, small landowners nationwide, and found that it's, even though there are a large number of small forest landowners, and in this state I think it's in excess of 200,000, that the percentage of those forest landowners that really identify themselves as active forest managers is much lower. It's somewhere in the teens. And this is the first time I'd seen this statistic, but it maybe indicates to us that we need to target both education as well as the survey on trying to find those small forest landowners that are most active in the process. Industrial landowners, you know, have fairly good and broad communication with tribes, and I think that enhancing that is also important in the process. So with that, I'm going to turn it back to Jeffrey.
Thank you, Jenna. And might I note, just as an observation, that only 11% of the responses that were got for the survey actually came from tribal affiliates and staff. So the Cultural Resources Protection Management Guidance documents that were worked upon during the year was a continuation of work that had begun in 2011 and had proceeded during 2012 and of course on through 2013, and we hope to start really capping off come 2014. Just to summarize the progress, there were five of the documents that were completed and posted upon TFW and Forest and Fish Report websites, and there's five more documents that are close to completion, but three new enhancements were identified to add into the guidance documents package, and you see on your list five of those, but there, a couple of them are really just editorial. And so the ones that were completed would be the documents that provide guidance pertaining, describing types of sites commonly found in the forest, that's a video, how to complete a successful site protection plan, how to complete the CEPA checklist question number 13 for cultural resources, what to do if you find human remains, and the historic maps and information users guidance. So we're really happy to have those items now available for public appreciation and landowner usage, and we do also look forward to completing those other documents on what is a cultural resource, general information about cultural resources and forest practices, landowner tribal meetings under WAC 222-2120, as well as a tribal contacts list and landowner contacts list. As far as our outreach and education work goes, one of the most important purposes of this Cultural Resource Protection Management Plan is to ensure that cultural resource protection is accomplished through cooperative processes. And as such, education and training are key to imparting the knowledge and understanding that is needed to support cooperation and cultural resource protection. So we all know that the Cultural Resource Protection Management Plan does refer to education. It has a section specific to education, and that the small forest landowners have their own section in there, for example, and that it also refers in the education program for small forest landowners to benefit from the educational program undertaken through the CRUMP.
In this regard, we can then report of work that's been undertaken over the years by the Washington State University Cooperative Extension, Jim Freed in particular, and he reported to our group earlier this year about his the successes he's having in working with the small forest landowner community and ensuring that they are connected to at least tribal families, if not communities within areas, and that ways for them to work together and interact, and for tribes to access those small forest lands and obtain cultural materials or otherwise undertake cultural activities important to them. Those things is what he's been working hard to promote. We did ask about whether or not that's really being connected to the Forest Practices Application reviews yet, and it doesn't seem as if it is. And it also doesn't seem as if there's really good crossover between the work being undertaken by the Cultural Resources Roundtable, which of course is a TFW established committee, and that of the Small Forest Landowner Office and the Advisory Council there, the committee there. And so we really just like to encourage that kind of interaction to occur so that we can be sure that this work that with the WASI Cooperative Extension that is occurring in conjunction with the Small Forest Landowner's Office is really connected over to what we have otherwise established and really provided a platform to occur through the crop. So just make sure everything's really working together. That's all I want to say. You know, it gets down to things like integration and overall commitment. But I also want to mention that the educational video that Lee Stilson of this Department of Natural Resources State Lands was the principal in producing under sponsorship through WFPA and in partnership with Quinault Tribe. But the Cultural Resources on Forest Lands educational video is now posted upon the DNR websites, and so you know we consider that to be a very important step in terms of cultural resource protection, as well as in being sure that landowners get the educational tools that they need. In that regard, just want to now mention anticipated activities. But Karen, would you like to take over for now?
Sure. Since we didn't have the break, our segues are a little bit rough here. But anyway, in terms of what we're doing next year, again, we're going to really focus on education and outreach. And that is a major part of what the roundtable does. And we anticipate developing a presentation that can be utilized in TFW regional meetings. We'd also like to have roundtable participants visit some of those meetings to talk about cultural resources. We're very interested in trying to figure out ways to assist younger foresters in terms of understanding how important cultural resources are, how to identify them, how to work with tribes. And so we'll be trying to do a few social media type things, dipping our toes in that, and we'll let you know how that went next year. And then just in terms of the overall process, as Jeffrey alluded to, we are in the process of updating the guidance for the CRUMP. And one thing that is really critical for that is to have some staff support to be able to do that. So don't be surprised if we ask for some additional resources to help us through that process of combining and putting together the guidance as well as education and outreach. We have an incredible group of roundtable participants, but they all have other jobs, and so it's helpful if we can get a little bit of coordination from the department in terms of assisting us to move forward in that process. So the last words, of course, are Jeffrey's.
No last words from me. Just thank you for your continued support.
So I'd like to offer on two items with respect to coordination with the Small Forest Landowner Advisory Committee. For part of the department, I'll instruct the committee to arrange at least one annual meeting with the Cultural Resources Roundtable to ensure that we've got a higher level of coordination. And with respect to the staff support on documents and getting documents formatted and online, I've committed to that already, and so you can consider that done. So you'll have the support of at least as much as I can make our communication staff available to help go through the documents either, but in an appropriate place on the department's website and anywhere else you'd like them to. We'll get that done. Thank you both very much. I also want to say, you might know we had an issue or two in legislative session around cultural resource support practices application procedures. I think the question 7 instructions update is really important and an excellent piece of work, and I thank you very much for it. I think as we adapt the survey process and can learn if there are more different information that we can provide in the way of application instructions, that helps people know what's expected of them up front. And we don't encounter this rushed situation where a sit down and a genuine discussion between a landowner and a tribe occurs in some circumstance where the landowner is uncomfortable or the tribe feels like it was an afterthought, or it helps us have that fidelity to the upfront coordination. I really appreciate your work on the instructions and making that information available to the landowners and fans.
Might I comment that the local governmental relationship with the TFW stakeholders in my area is especially important, but especially underserved. And we're really struggling with how do we work effectively with local government when they're not sure if they're in the TFW stakeholder community or not.
Is there some further roundtable discussion?
Well, I've mentioned that just because a lot of the cultural resources work that we're contemplating in my area has a lot to do with local lands that are within local governmental jurisdiction or where they have an influence. Right. And we want to be able to be sure, at least it's qualified, that we can work through those issues seamlessly.
I see that's an issue.
Thank you.
Other questions?
I have a comment. When your cultural resource outreach for education, do you have a plan to visit with the schools, the high schools and the junior highs, figure out some way to get this information out to them?
I don't think we have an actual formal plan at this point, but what we're really focusing on at this point is getting information out to foresters. And so as we go through this process of trying to develop more education outreach materials and opportunities, talking to some of the schools that do have forestry departments, I think would be an important element to that, just so that people get that understanding early in their career. And in terms of outreach to individual schools like high schools or even other schools that are lower down in the grade levels, we haven't really developed anything as far as I know about that. But Jeffrey may have some additional comments. This is my second meeting being co-chair, so.
And we certainly treasure her participation and involvement. As a WFPA affiliate, I'm sure that Karen is aware of their partnership, I believe it is, with the Pacific Education Institute. And for me, that's an untapped resource. It's one that the Cultural Resources Roundtable simply hasn't been made aware of, let alone contemplated how we somehow use that as a venue for reaching out to youth. I would like to mention that for 2013, in the years just now wrapped up, the Puyallup Tribe did obtain funding through this Forest and Fish Support Account to undertake a youth and community education project. And so we undertook a linking tribal youth to local forest education project, and through that we developed a number of educational materials, just drawing attention to the existence of the Timber Fish and Wildlife Program and what the purposes of the program were for, and that its work did extend watershed wide, and that we believe that was important for the tribal youth and community to be aware of and find their own personal and interesting ways to connect that too. So we want to make sure that they know the forests are out there. We want to know that the Timber Fish and Wildlife Agreement highlights that cultural practices, activities that haven't been practiced in there for some time due to access, may be reestablished, and that's been out there for 25 years. And so what does that mean to the kids of today? What does that mean to the non-tribal youth of a watershed? And so we're very interested in determining how our efforts focused mostly upon tribal community for starters can now be extended out to the other local interests in our watershed as well. Here in the Puyallup area, we have Sumner, we have Puyallup, Ording, Bonnie Lake, Buckley, Enumclaw. Those are all kids that I'm sure can relate to the existence of their local forest, but do they have the right kind of information that's going to possibly bring them into public meetings or otherwise pursue forestry or other natural resource careers. That's what we want to be sure is happening.
Thank you both. With that, unless there's objection, we're going to recess for 12 minutes. Come back at 10:30, please.